Okay, we're now in the middle of Daniel chapter 11, and once again, as I studied for this, I'm reminded, based on what other people are saying out there, that this is perhaps, according to many, the most difficult chapter in all of the whole Bible to interpret and understand. So we're going to give it our best shot. We're covering only a half of it. The first part was last week, of course, and we've got a large section this evening, but to remind us of what's going on here, Daniel is a prophet of the Old Testament, a great man of God, and he is in the middle of a conversation with an angel that has appeared to him for the explicit purpose of explaining to him some of the difficult things that he's been seeing in visions and bringing to his understanding what those things really mean. Now, early on in his life, Daniel, very early in the days of Nebuchadnezzar the king, and Daniel's been alive through a succession of kings in Babylon, but even in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, God had been communicating to Daniel and showing him how the Jews would be in the future just continually oppressed. Daniel was a Jew, and his concern would have been for his own people and their position really within the will of God and the kingdom of God. And so God had been showing him what the future held for them, and it wasn't pretty. Even now, Daniel is an old man. He's roughly 85 years old. And at this point in his life, it's becoming clearer than ever that the 70-year Babylonian captivity that he had endured throughout his life, he had survived the entire thing, being born in Israel, but then being kidnapped and taken to a foreign country, Babylon. He had been there for over 70 years, and now as an 85-year-old man, it's becoming clearer than ever that that captivity was just the beginning. That God was punishing Israel for generation after generation of idolatry and sin upon sin and all the rest, and now it had come to its fruition, and this was just the beginning. The future would be filled with as much conflict as the past was. Violence, all kinds of trouble for the people of God. And now this is the last of four prophetic episodes that are recorded for us here in this book, but it's now that Daniel is learning that Syria, to the very north of Israel, would be at war with Egypt, to the very south of Israel, for centuries in the future, with Israel, of course, sandwiched in between the two and really bearing the brunt of their back-and-forth conflict. And all of this culminates, and in the first 20 verses, we dealt with this last week about the Syrian and the Egyptian conflict, really the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic dynasties. Those are those two. And so now we come to verse 21, where there is a culmination in all of this conflict that results in the uprising of some vile person. In 21, it says, in his place, and that was the former king of Syria, now comes a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, so it's not going to be given to him or bestowed upon him. He's actually, it says, going to come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So apparently there would, in the future, come a vile person to take the place of the one who is now deceased. Seleucus the IV, Philopater, he was the king of Syria who died in verse 20. If you remember, he died mysteriously. If you look at the end of verse 20, he didn't die in anger or in battle. Really, there's a mystery surrounding his death. Some suggest that he was perhaps poisoned, but nobody knows for sure. And when he died, the rightful heir to the throne was the first of two sons, whose name was Demetrius Soter. Again, tonight's going to be filled with names and dates and all this fantastic, boring information, unless you're really a history nut, okay? But there's, again, some things to be gleaned from this text, so hang in there. But the heir to the throne was Demetrius Soter, who was at that time still a very young boy. And a man named Antiochus Epiphanes heard about the situation. He heard that the king of Syria died, and this Antiochus Epiphanes, who we read about in chapter 8, there's some details given about this man. We're going to rehash a few of those tonight. But he came up to Syria, hearing about the situation there, claiming to be the lawful protector of that young boy, the heir to the throne. And so he assumed guardianship over that boy. And by doing so, he was able to successfully take the throne for himself, not by force, but by the word in the Old King James here is intrigue. It's an interesting Hebrew word. It actually means slippery. This Antiochus Epiphanes was a slippery man, smooth talker, we might say, very crafty. He was the kind of guy who could read people, anticipate outcomes, and then manipulate the situation accordingly. He has what one called diplomatic charm. I like that. He had diplomatic charm, knew how to work people over and take a certain angle. He was able to camouflage his dominating self-interests with what appeared to be generosity and concern for others. All of which combined to make him one of the most successful politicians of his era. This is nothing new to us. This really seems to profile the average politician of our day. But by God's standards, he was vile. That's the Hebrew word, vile. It means despicable. He made a name for himself. Antiochus Epiphanes was his name, but the name he made for himself was Theos Epiphanes. You know what that means? God manifest. God man. He was a very egotistical individual. Had a lot of, really, you might say mental illness, thinking so highly of himself. He eventually earned the nickname Epimenes, which means madman. So he called himself Godman, but he earned the reputation as a madman. And at this point, I would like to just pause and say that every one of us in here has perhaps not identical opportunity that this man did, but similar ones in the sense that you can go through life and strive to create a name for yourself. And a lot of people do that. They want to make a name for themselves. You can do that. Or you can faithfully serve the Lord Jesus Christ and allow him to give you a new name altogether. And that is exactly what Jesus promises to do in Revelation 2:17, quote, to him who overcomes. Meaning, to the one who through faith in him overcomes the temptations of the world, the enticements of the world, all of the sins of this world, and continues to serve Jesus throughout their life, Jesus says, I will give you a new name that no one understands except the one who receives it. That sounds good to me. I certainly don't want to be known as a madman. Well, in verse 22, with the force of a flood, we're told, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So here now, in this section, we're told that this Antiochus Epiphanes, we only know that it's Antiochus Epiphanes because we can look back in history and know this for a fact. Again, Daniel is receiving this information, and to him it was still yet future, so he didn't know these names, but we do. And so this Antiochus Epiphanes apparently would come in peaceably, which he did. But his influence here in verse 22 is described as the force of a flood, which to me sounds a bit violent. You know, you're thinking tidal wave, tsunami type of stuff. There's a lot of force behind that. So what seems peaceable on the outside, in truth, something altogether different. And I want to tell you, warn you really, that you should never underestimate a person's potential for evil and deceit and brutality just because they appear to be agreeable on the outside. You don't know somebody until you know them. Another detail in this situation is that Rome had weakened Syria. So by the time Antiochus Epiphanes took over, they were at a very disadvantaged position. Okay, but under his leadership, they began to recover and grow strong. It says that he had a small number of people, but that he became strong with them, right? Here's how he did it. We're told in verse 24, he went into the richest places of the province and do what none of his fathers had done, or his forefathers. You know what he did? He dispersed among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. You know what that means? And history verifies this. He gained support by robbing the richest parts of his own kingdom and then distributing that wealth to the poor. Okay? Call it government handouts. And I'll tell you, government handouts will win votes, but it is not a sustainable plan. Did you notice in verse 24 it says, but only for a time? It doesn't work forever, okay? Can I make just a brief political commentary just because it was election last Tuesday? Now, I am not really, you guys know that I don't do this very often, but in studying for this, I found it interesting that New York City just elected a mayor named Zohran Mamdani. You know what his platform was? Tax the rich, give breaks to the poor. Free bus passes, free childcare, freeze the rent, and increase the minimum wage of New York City from $16.50 an hour to $30. Cheap votes, if you ask me, and he won. Okay? So back to our story here in prophecy. And by the way, as a side note, I'm not saying anything about the mayor of New York. Oh, he's the Antichrist. I didn't say that, but wouldn't it be crazy if it ended up being that way? Yeah. What I would say is that his election only shows how ready not only New York City is, but perhaps many in our country, not to mention the world, for an Antichrist. Somebody who is going to come in peaceably like he did, Antiochus Epiphanes, which is a foreshadow of the Antichrist to come. Come in peaceably, come in as a no-name, come in unpolitical, and somehow take great power. And by the way, this mayor of New York was literally a no-name and now is the mayor of the biggest city in our country and the youngest mayor since the 1800s. So this is unprecedented. He's also Muslim, if that matters. At any rate, just a little bit of coincidence that I found since that was within the week. But here now, back to our story here, this prophecy. At the same time that this is all going on, Antiochus Epiphanes showing interest in the establishment of a state religion. Okay, if you notice, he's already going after Judaism. He's wanting to establish something different, even in Israel. If you look at the end of verse 22, it says, also the prince of the covenant. That's very telling. Now, it seems a bit obscure in this verse. If we were going on prophecy alone, it'd be hard to know what that meant. However, history tells us that there was a high priest in Israel at that time named Ananias III, and he was the one referred to here as the Prince of the Covenant. That was a very, very favorable term for the high priest. Ananias was one who sought to preserve the Jewish religion or the covenant from being tampered with, which was what Antiochus Epiphanes was attempting to do. Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to assimilate Greek culture into Israel. Ananias III was taking a stand against that, and so Antiochus Epiphanes had Ananias III deported and then murdered in 172 BC, and then he replaced him with his brother Jason, who had no interest in the traditions of his fathers. Jason was an absolute sellout. This is no commentary on anybody that we might know named Jason. But this one was an absolute sellout. Meanwhile, there's an ongoing continual conflict with Egypt. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, that's Egypt, with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army of his own. Dun, da, da, da. But he shall not stand. For they, who are they? We'll find out. Shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacies. There's some details. They are going to be the ones to destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. So here, history will reveal. Antiochus Epiphanes marched against Egypt with a huge army, as it was foretold. They fought in Pelusium. I think it's at the mouth of the delta of the Nile River. Lots of Egyptians died in that battle. Their king, the king of Egypt, Ptolemy the VI, Philometor, he was defeated. No surprise there, based on what we just read. And taken hostage. Now, the reason why is given, though it's a bit veiled in verse 26, those who ate of the portion of his delicacies were responsible for destroying him. History tells us that it was some of his own counselors that betrayed him because they were really in support of the Syrian army that had come against them. And that's so what's meant when it says what it does in verse 25 and 26 here. And so that king then was replaced by his own brother, His brother's name was Ptolemy the VIII Euergetes. Okay, another Ptolemy, but different name. So the king of the south of Egypt was replaced by his brother. Now, verse 27 says, both these kings' hearts, now that would be the king of Egypt and Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of Syria, both of their hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. So apparently these two kings got together, Antiochus Epiphanes and the defeated brother, the one he had just kidnapped, taken hostage. Apparently they sat down at a table and tried to talk peace treaties. You know, this happens in different countries. They get together, the king of this country and the king of that country, and they talk and they wheel and they deal as if they had each other's best interests in mind. They never do. They never, ever, ever do. Okay? And this was no exception. So Antiochus Epiphanes pretended to befriend the kidnapped king in order to get his help defeating the newly elected brother, promising the kidnapped king that they could reconquer Egypt and that Antiochus Epiphanes would restore the former king to the throne. And guess what Ptolemy did in response? He pretended to believe him. I mean, isn't that how it works? Oh, okay. Both of these men were manipulating each other to gain control of Egypt. And guess what happened in the end? They both failed. Guess why? Partly because, as one author says, hell won't even cooperate with itself. So you have two agents of Satan, ultimately, trying to strike a bargain with each other, and they can't figure out a deal. Both of them fueled by the fires of hell, and they can't reach an agreement. So that's part of the reason. The other part of the reason is given in the end of verse 27 when it says, the end will still be at the appointed time. God's like, no, you're not going to strike a peace deal because I want there to be conflict because I'm not done punishing Israel yet, and you guys need to keep crisscrossing their nation and fighting with each other and making their life a living hell because this is what their sins have done. So there's no escaping God's punishment once it's begun. It will run its full course, whether it be for nations or individuals, and God will have his way. In verse 28, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart, Antiochus Epiphanes, he's going back to Syria now, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, that would be Israel, that's a synonym for Israel, so he shall do damage and then return to his own land. So on his way back to Syria, this happened in 170 BC, something moved his heart against the Jewish people. Isn't that weird? What do you think moved his heart against the Jewish people? Could have been God. Could have been God. You're like, well, God would never do that. Yes, God does, and he did. And this is how it all started with Nebuchadnezzar ransacking Jerusalem. You remember? God ordained Nebuchadnezzar to go and deport all of these Jews and start the process of their, what we would call chastisement. But his heart is moved against the Jewish people. And so he stops there in Israel, and while he's there, he plundered and defiled the temple and killed 80,000 Hebrews. This is one of the darkest days in their history. Covered that a little bit in chapters prior, but what triggered all of this? I mean, God may have been the one to move his heart. I wouldn't argue that. But what were the variables that really set this thing in motion? I'll tell you what it was. Do you remember Jason, the sellout? He was now the high priest in Israel. He had been high priest since his brother Onias was executed. Sometime after that, not sure exactly how much time had passed, but Antiochus Epiphanes removed Jason from the position of high priest and replaced him with a man named Menelaus. You know why? Menelaus was a good briber. And apparently Menelaus offered Antiochus Epiphanes more money than Jason ever did. And Menelaus was apparently as spiritually compromised as Jason ever was, so either one would do, and the position goes to the highest bidder, right? And Menelaus won. So while Antiochus Epiphanes was fighting in Egypt, Jason, who was still serving as high priest, heard a rumor that Antiochus Epiphanes had died, and so what he did was he raised a small army of Jews and attacked Jerusalem to overthrow Menelaus, who had gotten the position, and Jason wanted his old job back. And so he raises a small army, goes into Jerusalem, attacks Menelaus. Menelaus defends himself against the attack. And once this all happened because it was rumored that Antiochus Epiphanes was dead. And he wasn't. And once he heard about this, he decided to teach those rebel Jews a lesson on his way back through. And so he did. He killed, tortured, raped, and enslaved thousands, which sent a clear message to the Jews. The ones that survived, one thing was clear: don't challenge the state religion, or else don't you dare challenge the state religion. In verse 29, at the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore, and he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant. He's going to go back to Israel and do more damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He's going to reward the apostates. He's going to reward those who defect from Judaism and ascribe to the state religion. Okay? And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. He's going to flatter them, right? But the people who know their God are going to stand strong and carry out great exploits. So 2 years later, 2 years had passed, Antiochus invaded Egypt again, but it wasn't like the former or the latter. Something different this time. You know what it was? Rome got involved. The Romans came and they intercepted and they told him to stop. This right here would be a low point in the career of Antiochus Epiphanes. What happened was the Romans would send Popilius Laenus, some Roman commander, with a fleet of trireme ships, I'll explain, to protect Egypt. Antiochus was coming with Syria to invade Egypt again. Rome steps in and goes, uh-uh. And apparently, you know, look at verse 30, the ships from Cyprus came against him. These are these trireme ships. I did a little bit of research. Apparently, these ships were the ultimate warship. They were 120 feet long, 20 feet wide, and they contained 170 oarsmen. You know, like horsepower? This is like, I don't know, manpower, oar power. This was a ship to be reckoned with. It was very fast and very agile. And they fortified the bow of the ship with bronze, solid bronze. And it turned the vessel into a massive battering ram. It would just slam and blast through the broadside of an enemy ship to sink it. They were greatly feared. This was the most high-tech weapon of that era. Not elephants. Okay? Not elephants. These kinds of ships were so dominant at sea warfare, it allowed them to establish what was then called a thalassocracy, an empire at sea. An empire at sea. You had these warships, you owned the water. And now here comes Rome with all of these, and Antiochus is on the beach going, ugh. When they met on the beach, Antiochus was familiar with the commander, Laenus, and went out to shake his hand, but the commander refused to shake his hand and told him instead that the Roman Senate wanted him to leave Egypt. They weren't buddies anymore. And when Antiochus Epiphanes hesitated, the commander took his cane and drew a circle all the way around Antiochus Epiphanes and told him that he needed to decide whether to leave Egypt or to fight Rome before he was allowed to leave that circle. He had good reason to fear Rome, good reason to fear the commander right there. And so he backed down, which was probably harder on his ego than any actual defeat would have been. In fact, it says in verse 30 that he would return to Israel in rage. And the word rage there in Hebrew means foaming at the mouth. And so the stubborn purists among the Jews who refused to apostatize, and they were determined to remain faithful to their God and the God of their fathers, weren't making Antiochus Epiphanes' life any easier, and so he's going to take it out on them, and they're going to bear the brunt of it. One commentary says, he ordered his general, Apollonius, to occupy Jerusalem with the Syrian army for the purpose of stamping out every trace of Judaism. An edict was made that all nationalities in the kingdom were to worship Greek deities. The temple sacrifices were stopped. Syrian soldiers and harlots performed licentious heathen rites in the temple courts, if you can imagine what that might have been. Pigs were sacrificed to pagan deities in the temple, total desecration of the Jewish system. The Jewish people were required to take part in a drunken orgy in honor of Bacchus, the god of wine. Jews who remained loyal to God were put to death. The holy scriptures were ordered by Antiochus to be absolutely destroyed. Destroy the Bible. And the temple was theretofore dedicated to Zeus. So, foaming at the mouth, Antiochus Epiphanes took out his rage on the Jews. And history will bear this out. Verse 33 says, and those of the people who understand, these are the loyal Jews, shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue. And some of those who of understanding shall fall to refine them and purify them and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So apparently, according to this passage, there would be a faithful remnant of Jews that would continue in faith to God, with the majority of the Jews already having been given over to just wholesale apostasy. And the high priest himself, if you remember, Menelaus, he converted to paganism and was now an ordained priest of Zeus. So what a guy. At any rate, there was in that area a man named Mattathias Maccabeus. He, along with his five sons, refused to bow their knee to Zeus or any of the pagan deities or any of the demands of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, if you grew up Catholic, you might have heard of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. It's in their Bible. It isn't recognized by Protestants as being inspired by God, so it's been left out for good reason. However, it's good history. You can read all the account there in 1st Maccabees especially. But this Mattathias Maccabeus killed the officer who tried to make him sacrifice to Zeus. Well, you know, you can't just go around doing that. So him and his family fled to the hills. That move actually bolstered the faith of a few others who joined them in what's called the Maccabean Revolt. That revolt would ultimately be led by one of the five sons named Judas. Judas Maccabeus, his nickname was The Hammer. How you like that? The Hammer. Many of these people were caught, tortured, and killed for their revolt, but they remained loyal to God. Now, why did that happen? Why did God allow it? It says in this text that it happened to refine them, purify them, and make them white. Apparently, nothing so cleanses the congregation of the Lord like the threat of suffering, loss, and death. If that wasn't true, God would save us from it, but he allows us to experience things like this to have its cleansing effect that he intends on any congregation that he should so choose. If he doesn't spare Israel, he wouldn't spare anybody else either. And I'll tell you this, you know what that ends up doing in a situation like that? Those who compromise under pressure get separated out, and the whole family of God is better off for it. And so God does that same thing to this day, even in the church. God will sovereignly force you to pick between obedience and denial. Aren't you glad for free will? Everybody in here gets to choose whether they will be a person of integrity or a traitor to the faith. Because everybody gets tested. Everybody. Maybe not with the threat of death. Might not happen to us in this room. But it will be with the possibility of losing the safe and comfortable life that you were hoping for. You pick. What kind of a person do you want to be? It wasn't long after that, that on December 14th, 165 BC, they purified the temple once again and rededicated the altar to God. It's an event that's still celebrated today. You've heard of it. Hanukkah. Antiochus Epiphanes would die less than 2 years later. What a shame for those who turned their back on the covenant. If they only would have hung on, been willing to camp out in the woods for a year and a half, God would have spared them too, purified them too. But no, it's too late. What's done is done. They turned their back on the God of their fathers. In verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. Here's what's interesting. First 35 verses, we've been reading prophecy after prophecy, 135 of them to be exact, all of which can be verified in world history. In verse 36, things change because there are prophecies here that Antiochus Epiphanes never fulfilled, and neither has anybody. Nobody's fulfilled the prophecies of verse 36. So all commentaries would agree that there is, between verse 35 and verse 36, a great leap of time that takes place. Verse 35 and prior was a history lesson, but prophecy begins with verse 36. This has not happened yet, not even to this very day. So who is this king that's being spoken of in verse 36? It is the Antichrist himself. The Antichrist is someone that is foretold in this passage and many others, and he has yet to rise. Now, the prophecies that are found in the rest of chapter 11 here correspond perfectly to prophecies that are found elsewhere in the New Testament concerning the Antichrist. So this is well known, that we're no longer talking about Syrian kings or Egyptian wars or anything. We're talking about something that's yet future. In fact, in about 600 years later, in 417 AD, so this is AD, not BC, 417 AD, Jerome, early church father, he wrote about how even the Jews considered this to be yet future, which is remarkable to me because it would be harder for the Jews than perhaps any other people group on earth to admit that this was still future, because that would mean that the time of their suffering still wasn't over and wouldn't be until the very end. So you thought the Babylonian captivity was just the beginning. Verse 37 says, he, the Antichrist, shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. Apparently, this individual is going to have a complete lack of regard for all of those sort of influences that seem to have sway over normal men, one of them being religion, another one being women, another being a god of any kind. This guy has no regard for any of those things. This guy is self-exalting like no one before him. 2 Thessalonians 2:4 says, he will exalt himself and defy everything that people call God and every object of worship. He will even sit in the temple of God, claiming that he himself is God. So he don't care about religion. And then there's something apparently about his attitude toward women that's going to set him apart from traditional men. This individual is going to be immune to any seduction or manipulation by the opposite sex because he has no interest. Some conclude, based on what's said here, that he'll be homosexual. Some might conclude that he is perhaps heterosexual, but misogynistic, means he has a real problem with women. It may mean neither. Whatever the case is, the trite pleasures of normal human life will be beneath him. He didn't need any of it. Sex, marriage, family won't have any appeal whatsoever. And since it doesn't, it won't serve as a distraction to him. This man is going to have one singular focus in his mission to establish a kingdom, control the subjects of it, and receive praise from them. That's all he wants to do. In verse 38, but in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. So this guy is going to have an unparalleled spirit of independence about him, and it's going to be seen in the fact that he seeks no assistance or favor from any god, no pleasure or help from women. He puts no hope or stock in progeny or having a successor, somebody to inherit his throne. It's almost like he knows that this is going to be how the world ends and there will be no such thing as a successor, but that Christ is going to come back and rule in his stead. It's almost like he knows this. He doesn't care to have a son. He doesn't care to have somebody to pass the kingdom on to. He knows the kingdom won't last. He knows that this is his last hurrah. And so he's going to give it everything he's got. So the only thing of value to himself outside of himself will be the advantage gained by military strength. And for that reason, the Bible says here, he will spare no expense, right? Gold, silver, precious stones, pleasant things. He will surrender the priciest of material goods to fortify and supplement his arsenal. He's going to build up a military like none other. He will stop at nothing to become king of the world. What a counterfeit this is. I mean, this is the guy that's going to precede the return of Jesus Christ. He will rule the world, and then Jesus will destroy him, and Jesus will be his successor. What a sharp contrast, and what a counterfeit the Antichrist is to the true and living Jesus Christ. The Antichrist, here's a couple of comparisons, the Antichrist is going to try and conquer the world by killing. Jesus already did it by dying. What a contrast, huh? Jesus told me and you that the meek shall inherit the earth. The Antichrist tries to take it by force. And I want you to notice what a fraud this guy is. Notice how he is going to, in verse 39 at the end, it says, he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. The Antichrist is going to give land and rulership to those who are most loyal to him. Hey, wait, that sounds like something that Jesus promised to do. He said, if I'm faithful in a few things, he's going to make me a ruler over many cities. So apparently in the new earth, Jesus is going to do for us, if we're loyal to him now, what the Antichrist is going to do in the old earth for those who are loyal to him. I guess I'd rather be part of an everlasting kingdom than a one like the Antichrist offers to people that's going to come to a fast and sudden ruin. At any rate, let's read in the end here. Verse 40 says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. Probably not actual chariots and horsemen, but the modern counterpart, whatever that'll be at that time. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, Israel, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. and he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. You look at, he's going to get all the precious gold stuff from Egypt, all those treasures, you know? This is like the stuff that you've seen in Indiana Jones. You guys watch Indiana Jones? Is that a thing? So this guy got to get all those weird cryptic statues and all that kind of stuff. I don't really know about that, but it tells us here that this is going to happen at the time of the end. You know what that means? This is Daniel's 70th week, if you remember the 70 weeks bit. This, to paraphrase what that is, this is Satan's finest hour. He's in his heyday now. His power, the devil's power, is given to the Antichrist, and it's at its height. So in this passage, we read about how he's going to dispose of the kings of the north and the south. The south at this point is more than just Egypt. It's probably going to be a coalition of African countries that see what this Antichrist man is doing and are going to try and resist him so that it doesn't happen to them. But they're going to lose. Ezekiel explains that the king of the north is far north. Now, the king of the north was Syria. That was immediately above Israel. But this is the far north. It says that many times. I think 38 verse 6, 38 verse 15, if I'm not mistaken, chapter 39 verse 2, far north, to distinguish it from Syria. You know what we're talking about here? We're given the names Gog, Magog, Meshech, and Tubal. These are ancient names for northern Mesopotamia and the Caucasus Mountains, which is modern-day Russia. In Ezekiel 38:5, it says that they are going to come, Russia will come with allies. Remember, this is still future. Russia's in the Bible. And Russia is going to descend with allies. We're told who they are in chapter 38, verse 5. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. Uh-oh. Now, you know who Persia is? Persia, yeah. Run. Persia is modern-day Iran. Here's what's interesting. Did a little research. Russia and Iran, if you don't know, have a mutual dislike as we speak. A mutual dislike for Israel and the West. And the Antichrist at this time will have signed a peace treaty with Israel. So he's on the side of the West. This mutual hatred for the West that we're seeing even today in Russia and Iran, has become the basis of their partnership, which has continued to improve since the 1990s. In January of this year, they actually signed a 20-year, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership treaty to deepen cooperation with one another in the areas of economics, energy, security, and defense. This treaty serves to strengthen both nations' positions against the West. I am not a prophecy nut and I don't make predictions, but I am drawing from a few modern realities here that should help us to understand that even if it's not around the corner, we're going in that direction. The needle of the compass is pointed to the end. These victories over Russia, the African coalition, are going to be very significant ones for the Antichrist because they will only help him feel his supernatural invincibility. The power is going to go to his head. He will then deify himself, demand worship, abolish all other religions, including the state religion, the apostate church, the harlot church of Revelation 17. He will even seek to change times and laws. We've dealt with that already in our studies. But he'll have total control such as that you won't even be able to buy or sell anything without compromising your faith. That's how it will culminate, and the end will come. Verse 45, at the very last line, it says, yet he shall come to his end. Even this guy will have an end. You could gain control over the whole world. This is Marvel comic stuff, right? Doesn't every villain want to control the world, right? They never do, because there's so Superman always butts in. Well, there's no Superman here. It's just this guy is going to climb to the very top. And Superman himself can't do it, yet Jesus Christ can, right? But there is no Superman. His end shall come, and look it, no one will help him. No one will help. The exploits of the Antichrist have been described for you and me in great detail by Daniel, by the Apostle John in Revelation, and in other places of Scripture. But his future is summed up in five sad words. Lots of detail in Scripture about the Antichrist, his exploits, how it all goes down, and yet it's all summed up in these five words. No one will help him. No one. And I ask you if anybody's fate could be any more tragic than that. And yet, I'm here to tell you that anybody who pushes God away and harms God's people and gives themselves over to what this world offers is going to, I guarantee you, in the end, find themselves alone. Whether it's the Antichrist or Antiochus Epiphanes or some no-name man or woman who's listening to me right now, I'm telling you that if you ignore God and you live a selfish life and you run over other people to create your own personally customized empire, you too will be abandoned by God and without hope in the end. That's the final declaration of Scripture. There is an appointed time for each one of us here. And God knows your future with as much specificity as he knew Israel's future. He knows your future with as much specificity as he knew Syria's future or Israel's future. He knows yours. God knows how things are going to happen for you. But he's not going to treat you like a robot and make you go against your will. In the end, you're going to do whatever you please. The historical figures in these prophecies, whether that be Cyrus or Daniel, Alexander the Great, Antiochus, Ptolemy, Menelaus, Judas Maccabees, or anybody else, these are all real people who made real decisions with real consequences. And you're a real person who's making real decisions with real consequences. You'll be held to the same level of accountability as anybody else. The Bible says in Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment. There have always been men throughout history who have done remarkable things in this world, and the future is going to have some of its own, but who cares what you did in life if in the end you're all alone with nobody to help you, not even God? I'll remind you before we leave, just in case you're unaware, that Jesus Christ is the one who helps. He is our present strength. He is our future hope. The Bible calls him our spiritual advocate. God will not judge us because if we have faith in Jesus, he will stand by our side on the day of judgment. If you have faith in him, you're safe only if you have faith in him. And if you do, no matter how tumultuous the future is, Jesus will rescue us from it or sustain you through it, I promise, because the Bible does. Suffering is inevitable. Those of you who attend this church, you already know that. God knows it's coming, but he doesn't tell us that to frighten us or discourage us. God tells us that suffering is on the horizon so that we can prepare for it and respond faithfully to it when it happens. He doesn't want you to crumble. He doesn't want any more Antiochus Epiphanes. He doesn't want any more Menelaus. He doesn't want it. You know what he wants? Faithful men and women who will not compromise. God, they're so few and far between these days. So few. Even the Christians aren't really Christian. You bring in an Antiochus Epiphanes, oh, they'll go apostate. No problem. Compromise my faith. Just let me live. Just let me have my comfort. Please don't make life hard for me. I'll renounce my faith. Worship Zeus. Okay. And you know that people are doing that for far less reasons. Nobody's holding a knife to your throat. We got no Antiochus Epiphanes coming in here threatening us. And yet people are like, oh, I'm busy. And God's like, I told you to serve me. I got other stuff going on. I'm living life. You know, I'm young and I got plans. You've denied the faith. You're worse than an unbeliever. And stop calling yourself a Christian. You've already done it. This is what God is trying to prevent. This is why he appeared to Daniel and said, write this down. This is why he inspired me to just on a crazy whim decide to teach through Daniel. Was that a mistake? I mean, God, this hasn't been easy. Why? Why are we all sitting here tonight of all nights? Why? Because God wants you to hear this. Because he doesn't want you to crumble. Because he wants you to be a man or a woman of faith. God wanted that for his people, Israel, too. So that in the future, when this happened, they would remain faithful. It was all pre-recorded. God said, hold on. You're going to get a whole string of really crazy rulers, north and south. They're going to be running back and forth across your lawn. It's going to be elephants and trireme ships. Hold on. Don't let go. Because even though hell was coming, Daniel's contemporary, Jeremiah, God was speaking through him too. And to the Jews through Jeremiah, God said, I know the plans I have for you. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Those words were spoken to the same people to whom God spoke when he wrote this bleak picture of the future. He goes, yes, it looks terrible, but I have a future. I have plans for you, and they're good. So now, tonight, you, since you're not a robot, get to decide what you want to believe and which direction you're going to point the needle of the compass. Are you going to be faithful to God, or are you going to renounce the faith by the way that you choose to live from this day forward?